Right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for making it back so promptly after lunch. It's my great honour and delight to welcome you to the afternoon session. I think we're in for a really good session in both halves of the session. But to start us off, we've got William Boyd. William Boyd, some of you will remember from when he appeared, was it 14, 15 years ago when Dean's Hall faced the other way? And he spoke so compellingly on the heart of the matter, I think, on that occasion. I really don't need to introduce him to you, do I? But I will. He's a very prolific, very successful, very well-regarded fiction writer, a novelist, a short story writer. He's a screenplay writer. You might know some of his work from some of the TV adaptations that have been made of his work, Any Human Heart, Restless, for instance. He's done work for the cinema, including a film called The Trench, which he actually directed himself to. And he's here today in particular because he's been engaged in writing a screenplay for an upcoming film of Green's last published novel, The Captain and the Enemy. So here's William Boyd.
Thank you very much. Everything working. You can hear me at the back. Good. Very happy to be here again. Thanks for braving the lovely weather. I'm going to talk about this adaptation that's underway. It's written, but we haven't started filming yet, so you're getting a work in progress to a certain extent. But it's quite an interesting situation, all things considered. I wrote my first draft of the film of The Captain and the Enemy about 2 years ago in 2019. And also, it coincidentally, in the summer of 2019, while I was working on the script, I found myself in Antibes for a prize-giving ceremony organized by my French publishers. I had 2 hours to kill, and so I decided to make a pilgrimage to the apartment block where Graham Greene had lived for some 25 years at the end of his life. So I went to the apartment building and had a snoop around, and I wrote a piece in the Times Literary Supplement about my visit, and I quote, "I decided to try and find the apartment block in Antibes, the town where Graham Greene had lived for the last decades of his life. The Résidence des Fleurs on the Avenue Pasteur. I found the street and I found the apartment without too much difficulty. Green moved here in 1966 when he was 62, and it became his permanent residence for the rest of his life. Born in 1903, he died in 1991, aged 86, having lived in every decade of the 20th century. I suppose in the 1960s, the Résidence des Fleurs was newly built, the very acme of chic, modern living. But when I saw it and wandered around its precincts, it was in bad shape, shabby with stained concrete. Its orange awnings over its serried balconies were tattered and smirched. The commercial premises on the ground floor looked low rent and gimcrack. A florist with a few parched ferns in the window, a grimy laundrette, a car hire firm. Curiously, its down-at-heel grubbiness made it seem very Greenian. On the wall by the main door was a small granite plaque about a foot square. Graham Greene vécu ici, 1966 to 1991. I know a few people who met Greene. Two journalist friends interviewed him in that very apartment in Antibes, and one of them, and this would have been 1987, told me that while he was interviewing Green, he spotted my novel, The New Confessions, that was sitting on Green's coffee table in his sitting room. Visual aid. This is the hardback first edition of the novel. It's a nice fantasy for me to indulge in, I suppose, that Graham Greene might actually have read my novel, or perhaps dipped in and read a few pages anyway. However, I have read a significant portion of everything Graham Greene wrote, and the Graham Greene novel that really influenced me in ways I can't quite analyze, as I was so young when I read it, maybe 14 or 15, was The Heart of the Matter. I didn't understand it on my first reading, but because it was set in West Africa, in Sierra Leone, a country I'd visited, it resonated with me. I was born and raised in West Africa, in Ghana and Nigeria. I regarded West Africa as my home for the first 20 or so years of my life. And the landscapes described in The Heart of the Matter, the ambience of Freetown, of the tropics, were familiar to me. The smells, the noises, the sights described by Greene were smells, noises, and sights all around me in Nigeria, where I read the book. The novel, I now believe, opened a door to me. It showed me, I think, the possibilities of taking a personal experience and turning it into fiction, into an art. I became a Graham Greene fan, and I've been reading Graham Greene ever since. Anyway, all this is a preamble to explaining how, a couple of years ago, when I was offered the chance to adapt The Captain and the Enemy as a film, I didn't hesitate for one second, even though I hadn't read the book. Is The Captain and the Enemy the great unread Graham Greene novel? People almost suspect you've made it up when you mention it. When I told friends, Graham Greene enthusiasts, that I was adapting The Captain and the Enemy, they would look puzzled, and I would say, you know, his last novel, and they'd mutter vaguely, frowning, that one. His last novel is almost like his second, The Name of Action, that he suppressed. Are these the two least read novels in his oeuvre? So let's just check this out. Can we take a quick straw poll? How many people in this room have read The Captain and the Enemy? Be honest, be honest. Show of hands. Yes, you see, well, that's pretty good, but this is a Graham Greene festival, after all. it sort of makes my point. Anyway, according to Richard Greene's recent excellent biography, Graham Greene was suffering from something of a writer's block in the 1970s, and rummaging in his files, came across a manuscript of a novel he'd started and laid aside. He picked it up again in the mid-1980s and started writing it again sporadically. "The story won't lie down," he remarked. He finished a first draft in 1987, and the book was published in 1988. It was to prove his last novel. The book, spoiler alert, I'm afraid, for those of you who haven't read it. The opening of the book is clearly set in the late 1950s. I can't prove it, but I suspect that the fragment of manuscript that Greene picked up was the description of the eponymous captain coming to a boarding school, very like this one, curiously, to collect a boy for an exeat. In fact, the boy, Jim, as the captain names him, is Jim Baxter, is a prize. The captain has won Jim in a high-stakes game of backgammon that he played with the boy's father the night before. Very Greenian touch, I think. Somehow totally implausible in real life, but entirely plausible in Greenland. The captain, who goes by various names, makes his living as a con man and a thief. He takes Jim to seedy Camden Town, to a young landlady come concierge, to a house of flats and bedsits, and her name is Lisa. Lisa is barren, as a result of a botched abortion she has had. The father of the aborted child was Jim's father, Mr. Baxter, another crook and con man, an ex-army buddy of the captain's. The captain brings Jim to Lisa as a surrogate child, and Jim comes to live with her. Something possible in the 1950s, I suppose, but not today, obviously. The captain, it's clear, is in love with Lisa. And they do have a strange, loving relationship, and make love, though the captain is often absent up to various nefarious ways of making money, much of which he sends home to Lisa. Time passes, Jim grows up and becomes a journalist, Lisa ages, the captain is more and more absent, money is sent from abroad, notably from Panama. Then we move on to part two of the novel, cut to 1977. We can date it precisely because the novel refers to the impending USA-Panama Treaty about the handing over of the Panama Canal to the Panamanian state. The second part of the novel takes place in Panama in the months leading up to the treaty. Lisa dies in a car crash. Jim flies to Panama to meet the captain and to tell him what's happened. But seeing how much the captain lives and is literally kept alive by his love for Lisa and his memories and fantasies about her, Jim can't bring himself to tell him the truth. The captain is now running guns from Panama to the Sandinista rebels in Nicaragua. He has his own light aircraft and undertakes these perilous missions at night, possibly indulging in a bit of marijuana dealing on the side. Jim is drawn into the captain's strange life and mooches around Panama City. One day, and I'm summarizing radically here, Jim inadvertently gives away the fact that Lisa has died in a car crash. The captain goes insane with grief. He jumps into his plane and, in a crazed kamikaze mission, flies to Nicaragua and crashes the plane into the private palatial bunker of President Somoza, dictator of Nicaragua. But in vain, the president is absent. Jim is believed to be complicit somehow and is picked up and interrogated by the shady chief of police in Panama, Colonel Martinez. Then Jim is killed himself in an accident on the way to the airport to catch a plane to Valparaiso. Martinez is in his office. He gets a phone call. He answers, listens, turns to the person he's talking to. The son has followed the father. But the father's dead. So is the son. He will never see Valparaiso. An accident on the way to the airport, if it really was an accident, which I doubt. The end. Yes, I know what you're thinking. Anyway, the book was, of course, published in 1988. The reviews were mixed, let's say. Respect for Green's tremendous body of work rather minimized criticism. Green himself, apparently, wasn't that satisfied with the novel. John le Carré thought that it showed that Green was written out. Jonathan Coe, however, praised it as one of his most purely enjoyable works. Brian Moore, who's often compared to Graham Greene, also praised it in the New York Times, though having read the review recently, one can sense Brian Moore's reservations between the lines, quote, "Mr. Greene can make the unlikely seem plausible." So I read the book, of course, before I agreed to write the screenplay, and I have to say I read with mounting astonishment and incredulity. To be honest, it really is a kind of dog's breakfast of a novel, broken backed in a major way by its two time periods and effectively two genres, from seedy social realism to the framework and atmosphere of a political thriller. The major flaw in the novel, and one that sinks it pretty much in my opinion, is Graham Greene's choice of narrative method. I cannot for the life of me understand why he chose to tell the story in this way. It's almost amateurish. The book we're reading, Captain and the Enemy, is in fact a manuscript actually being written by Jim, age 22, in 1977, while he is visiting the captain in Panama. He is writing a history of his relationship with the captain and Lisa. In fact, it's even more complicated than that because Jim is elaborating on and amending an earlier piece of writing that he did about his life, so there is another text that we hear about behind the text that we're actually reading. I'll give you just one example of the awful problems that this weird narrative setup gives Graham Greene. While I wait for Pablo, this is Jim writing, I am spending the time bringing the narrative to a close. With the captain dead, what is the point of continuing it? I realize more than ever that I am no writer. Yes, a real writer's ambition doesn't die with his main character. What now? I have a return ticket to London, but I can turn that in, and the dollars left me by the captain and Mr. Quigley. The bell of my room is ringing. It's almost certainly Pablo coming to take me to see Colonel Martinez, and afterwards, what do I do? And on for another couple of paragraphs while the man who's ringing his doorbell waits for him to stop writing his memoir. So it's just astonishing to me that this particular framework was the one that Green chose to write the novel with. We're meant to believe that Jim is physically writing these words that I've just quoted, some hundreds of words, a page and a half, while someone is ringing the doorbell of his hotel suite to take him to an important appointment. This is, to put it bluntly, both impossible and, in terms of literary technique, inept. It draws wholly unwelcome attention to the creaky narrative device. If I were teaching a creative writing class and someone brought me The Captain and the Enemy to read, I'd say, there is a novel in here, yes, but this one isn't working, sorry. Back to the drawing board. And then, as if this creaking narrative method wasn't bad enough, we get, in part four of the novel, a complete shift of point of view. Jim throws his unfinished memoir in the waste paper basket. From having spent 99% of the novel in Jim's head, first person singular, we now suddenly enter Colonel Martinez's point of view, in the third person singular, past tense, for the last seven pages of the novel. This is desperate. It shows every sign of a writer who simply doesn't know how to end his novel, who realizes that he hasn't the energy to go back and rewrite the whole thing coherently. The book isn't a total failure, of course. It has its great moments of classic Graham Greene. It is very good in parts, but the few individual trees are more impressive than the entire wood itself, if you know what I mean. I did not despair, however. I told the producers I'd be absolutely delighted to write the screenplay of The Captain and the Enemy. Actually, it strikes me now, as I was preparing this talk, that Graham Greene's perverse decision to tell the story in this maddening way was, in a strange sense, the mirroring of his own faltering steps towards the finished novel. Blocked, he too found a few pages of a novel he had abandoned, and, vaguely inspired by what he read, he thought it might be continued. And over some years in the 1980s, he worked these pages up, this text, so to speak, into the novel that became The Captain and the Enemy. Jim's own struggles to complete his narrative, he never manages a conclusion, as we've seen, are inadvertently prefigured by Green's own struggles with the resurrection of a partial abandoned manuscript as a basis for a new novel. If that does explain his curious and very untypically ham-fisted method of narration, it still doesn't do him or the novel any favors, as we've seen. Anyway, I had now agreed to adapt The Captain and the Enemy into a feature film. There's an old adage in the movie business that goes like this: bad books make good films, good books make bad films. Actually, I don't believe this at all, in fact. Good books can make good films, and bad books can make bad films just as easily. But in this instance, it seemed to me that in adapting The Captain and the Enemy as a movie, a single feature film, it was the very marked difference between the two art forms, the novel and film, that would come to the rescue of The Captain, the Enemy, the book, and transform it into The Captain and the Enemy, the movie. What I'm going to say next is going to sound very banal, not to say stupid, but the great difference, the signal difference between the two art forms of film and the novel, and they are very, very different, and the source of all the difficulties of adaptation is because of the simple fact that film is photography. Think about it. There is fundamentally and almost omnipresently only one point of view in a film, the camera lens, and I include television in this. It's photography. You, the audience, the consumer, are always on the outside looking on. The massive, monstrous consequence of this is that film is ruthlessly, almost immovably objective. Subjectivity, the ability to enter a character's mind and know what he and she is feeling, is consequently difficult to achieve, and the means available to the filmmaker for approximating to the kind of subjectivity the novel excels in are actually very crude. You have voiceover, you have the use of the camera as point of view, and good acting, of course. But the best actor in the world cannot come close to reproducing the textures, nuances, and subtleties that can be found in one paragraph of a novel. I was once on a panel talking to an audience like this with a film director who disagreed with this theory of mine. So I read him a paragraph from my novel, Restless, which I'm going to do now, if you'll forgive the slightly vainglorious aspect of reading my novel in a Graham Greene lecture, but it makes the point very well and has a relevance. This is from my novel, Restless, which is a spy novel set in World War II, and the central character, young Russian woman who's been recruited by the British Secret Service, is sitting in a bus station in Edinburgh. Later, as she sat in the waiting room, waiting for the bus, she found herself looking at the other occupants of the small room also waiting for their buses, the men and women and the few children. She was examining them, evaluating them, assessing them, placing them. And she thought, if only you knew, if only you knew who I was and what I did. Then she caught herself almost exclaiming with surprise. She realized suddenly that everything had indeed changed, that she was now looking at the world in a different way. It was as if the nervous circuits in her brain had altered, as if she'd been rewired, and she knew that her lunch with Roma had marked both the end of something old and the beginning of something new. She understood now, with almost distressing clarity, that for the spy, the world and its people were different than they were for everybody else. With a small tremor of alarm, and, she had to admit, with a small tremor of excitement, she realized in that Edinburgh waiting room that she was looking at the world around her as a spy would. And I turned to this film director and I said, film that, mate. Impossible, absolutely impossible. That's just one paragraph of a novel. And what's embedded there, the layers of meaning, the way her thought processes are working, is physically impossible to film. We did film it. Hayley Atwell sat in the waiting room and looked at the people around her, thinking, but that was as close as we could get to the sophistication, if you like, and the density of information that the novel provides. And that is essentially the problem when you come to adapt a novel. You just cannot replicate what the novel does. Anyway, the point is that subjectivity is effortless in a novel. It is, and I believe, almost the defining feature of the novel form, that ability to enter into the minds of the novel's characters and know their most intimate thoughts. No other narrative art form can do it with the novel's sophistication and felicity, though theater can come close sometimes. You can write a 500-page novel simply exploring what one person is thinking and feeling. This is, to put it simply, the huge, unignorable difference between these two art forms. One is essentially objective, subjectivity is limited and crude. The other is wonderfully, perfectly subjective and can be perfectly objective if required. The novel gives you instant access to people's inner lives, and therein lies the novel's enduring allure and its unique power. But that's another story. Back to The Captain and the Enemy. In the case of The Captain and the Enemy, film's objectivity, its photography, came to our rescue. Graham Greene's terrible narrative template, the device of Jim's memoir, would have to be thrown out anyway, because as the book became a film, it is unreproducible on camera, as we've just seen. The film of The Captain and the Enemy would be an objective record of what happened in the novel, and thereby, I thought and hoped, would make it good. There are great pluses in The Captain and the Enemy, don't get me wrong, particularly when you start to envisage it as a film. In this last novel, Green revisited two of his familiar landscapes, post-war down at heel England and political mayhem and corruption in Central America. We would have in the film a wonderful opportunity also to revisit these familiar provinces of Greenland and see if we could make them new and fresh. There are also classic ambivalent Greenian characters. The captain, of course, raffish, falsely posh. Is he a fantasist? He goes on and on about his World War II experiences, escaping from a German prison camp, making his way alone across the Spanish border to safety, and so forth. And we have no idea at all if this is true. Lisa also is a typical Graham Greene woman figure, young, vulnerable, scarred, a victim, very conflicted about her love for the captain, tender towards Jim, a lost soul in a way. And Jim, the innocent young boy who grows up to be more callous and thoughtful in his 20s, self-absorbed, unfeeling, looking on, analyzing. These are the three principles. And as you're writing a screenplay, you do this, you know, inevitably, you're always mentally casting the roles you're writing. And all three of these roles, I reckoned, would attract major actors for the film. And there are some great secondary roles as well, who would be more fleshed out in a film version. Jim's loathsome father, Mr. Baxter, and a quiet American figure in Panama called Quigley. Quigley is a dubious American posing as a journalist. Who is he working for, Colonel Martinez or the CIA? Also, in its way, The Captain and the Enemy is a love story. Or as Brian Moore eloquently put it, it's a meditation on the ways of love. The captain loves Lisa, almost platonically, but they do have sexual relations, so internal evidence in the text confirms, or so I say, see page 60. Jim is intrigued by the captain and his relationship with Lisa, but he doesn't love the captain, even though Jim becomes a kind of surrogate son to him. Does Lisa love the captain? Hard to say. She consciously resists using the word. She loves Jim, that's for sure, but Jim doesn't really respond, especially as he grows older and leaves Lisa and the Camden flat for his adult life and becomes more distant emotionally. The fact is that all this classic Greeniana makes for a potentially very rich movie. The latest news on that front is that we have an Oscar-winning director attached. Asif Kapadia, his name is, who won an Oscar for his documentary about Amy Winehouse, which some of you may have seen. He's a Graham Greene fan, and the fact that this is one of the very few classic Graham Greene novels that hasn't ever been filmed is very appealing to him. But we're still some way off from shooting, I'm sad to say. There's been no talk of casting yet. Maybe next year, possibly, who knows, it's a very fickle business. And filming old Camden Town in England is no problem, but we can't film in Panama because it looks nothing like its 1977 city anymore. There is talk of the Canary Islands or Puerto Rico, but in a way it doesn't matter. Film is all about faking it, and I'm confident that wherever we wind up shooting Panama will look the real deal. I've written and revised the screenplay with Asif, and I'm sure there will be a few more passes at it. In its transformation from book to film, however, I have made a few changes. And the main changes I've made are these. I start the film with Jim in 1977, on his way to meet the captain in Panama. Lisa is dead, though we don't know this yet, and Jim has no real idea what the captain is up to in Panama. He arrives in Panama, he meets Quigley, who becomes an odd go-between figure, and is installed in a luxury hotel at the captain's expense. Then out of the blue, the captain arrives, and this triggers a long flashback to their first meeting at the school, which is the beginning of the novel, and the introduction to Lisa and the whole period of Jim's life in Camden Town. Film does the passage of time very easily, but of course we will need to have two actors playing Jim, one for the young 12-year-old and one for the 20-something. We need a lookalike. And as I was writing about the script, it struck me that Green's vagueness of the date for the Camden Town era is a bit of a problem. If Jim is 22, as he declares in 1977, then he would have been born in 1955. When he meets the captain for the first time, he says he's 12, so that meeting would have been in 1967. But there's absolutely no way that the world of Camden Town that Green conjures up is set in the swinging 60s. It's resolutely late 1950s. So I fudged it and set the first meeting between Jim and the captain in 1962, 15 years before the Panama sequence. The early 1960s in London were pretty much indistinguishable from the 1950s. Swing in London didn't really kick off until 1965, in fact. All of which makes Jim in the movie 27 years old, not 22. But that's easier to cast, actually, so that's a bonus. All this gives you a little insight in some of the complexities of adapting a novel into a film. You have to stay true to the spirit of the book, otherwise, why adapt it? But in any adaptation, the screenwriter should never be thinking of dogged fidelity, but should be trying to write the best film that he or she can. You must devote all your attention to the new medium and play to its strengths rather than the old one. Try to make a good film is the ambition, because the book, after all, will always be there. This maxim should be true of all adaptations of novels. The one other addition I made was to give Jim a love interest in the Panama section, to stop him being the cold and slightly creepily unpleasant character that he is in the novel. I've created a young part-time prostitute called Encarnacion, who reluctantly plies her trade in the luxury hotel, trying to make and save money so she can emigrate to America. Jim becomes obsessed with her, and in fact, she proves extremely helpful to him during the novel's denouement. That's another thing I had to change, practically forced to change it, the ending. Green's facile accident on the way to the airport that happens off stage as well and is only reported in a throwaway manner in the very last lines of the novel becomes a much bolder set piece and something of a cliffhanger. I play up the CIA collusion and meddling in Central American politics of the time, something Green was robustly opposed to, using Quigley, is he a double agent, as a key element in trying to secure Jim's safety as Colonel Martinez tries to shut him up permanently. Anyway, I'll say no more. You'll have to wait to see the film, if it ever gets made, to see if what I've done pays off or not. But that, anyway, is the story so far and where we are in what's known as the development period of a film. The next stage is pre-production, but God knows when that'll be. Anyway, in conclusion, I actually really enjoyed writing the screenplay of The Captain and the Enemy. Taking the novel apart and reconstituting it as a film was a pleasure, and working closely with Asif Kapadia, both of us trying to tease out and explore all the nuances and hints that are there in the book, albeit half realized or not fully developed. Our ambition as filmmakers is to make a film of The Captain and the Enemy that actually does more than justice to the book, to make a classic Graham Greene film that somehow fully bakes the somewhat half-baked novel that Graham Greene wrote. It's as if that, to extend the metaphor, in this novel, Greene has offered us the recipe and the ingredients for a dish, but the chefs, me and Asif Kapadia and the producers and the actors, now have an opportunity in cooking the thing up to maybe create a more toothsome dish than the one he provided. We shall see. Anyway, fingers crossed. However, I can't help thinking of the strange, Antibes connection in all this. The fact that I was in Antibes in 2019 as I was writing the script of The Captain and the Enemy and on a whim went to check out the Résidence des Fleurs where Green's apartment was, and the fact that I knew a journalist who had interviewed Green in that very apartment in 1987 and who had spotted my novel, New Confessions, on Graham Greene's coffee table in front of him. It would have been a hardback. New Confessions is a very distinctive hardback, as you've seen. And the New Confessions was published in 1987. And of course, 1987 was the year Green finished writing The Captain and the Enemy. For me, anyway, there's a curious 6 degrees of separation thing taking place. Obviously, impossibly, Graham Greene couldn't remotely have imagined or even dreamt of the fact that the author of the novel that was sitting in front of him on his coffee table would, some 30-odd years later, would be adapting the book that he'd just completed, The Captain and the Enemy, as a film. But from my point of view, as I think about it, as I posit the notion to myself, that curious coincidence in 1987, even if it's only a thought experiment in the end, seems like a strange, beguiling squaring of the circle, something to be relished, at least by me, if nobody else. Spooky. Thank you very much.
Time for questions.
Thank you, Mike. You know, you write popular literary fiction that is about things and are bestsellers. Do you worry that this will impact your long-term literary reputation because your novels aren't boring and impenetrable? Do you think that will affect you with academia?
I really don't care, to be honest. I do write literary fiction, but I'm a great believer in, you know, what E.M. Forster said, oh dear, yes, the novel is all about story and character. And I think that's fundamentally true to the form. If you don't engage a reader on that level, if you're only interested in style or some curious decrypting exercise that you're embarked on, you'll lose a lot of readers, because people go to novels for story and for character, and I believe to understand us, all these people on this curious adventure we're embarked on. And people are mysterious, people are opaque, even the people closest to you, they can tell you what they're thinking, but you may not necessarily believe them. And funnily enough, the paradox is the only place you can go to find out what people are actually thinking, and it's guaranteed as true, is in a work of fiction, because the novelist says it. And I do think, and I hinted at that in the speech, that that's another aspect of why people read novels. I mean, people write learned articles about my novels. I've had a few books written about my novels. I've appeared in books on the English novel in the 20th century, etc., etc. But I'm an ex-academic myself. I taught at university for 8 years, so I know that world and that game very well, and so I'm really not that bothered, to be honest. If the key aim is to, as Anton Chekhov said, be a free artist, and it's bloody difficult. And if you can write your books and they're published and you can earn a living and pay the rent as a free artist, then basically that's all any artist in any art form should be aiming for, and be very grateful indeed if they can pull it off.
I've only heard one other lecture on The Captain and the Enemy, and that was a few years ago here. And the not to try and summarise what she said, but the theme of what she was speaking about, this was Frances McCormack, was that the book was about unreliable memory And I just wonder whether you think The Captain and the Enemy is essentially an old man's book, and that the unevenness that you've described in it from the point of view of the narrator, and to do with the ages which you describe, the ages of Jim and so on, is Green saying, well, I can't, you know, I'm reflecting what old age is like, where you sort of remember things but you forget other things, and your memory is basically unreliable.
I'm not sure that is. I mean, we've, as filmmakers, we've addressed the question, you know, what is The Captain and the Enemy about? And I think fundamentally it is a kind of love story. And it's, as Brian Moore put it, it's about the ways of love. You know, it's the Jim's love, the captain's love, Lisa's love. And I think it is disorganized. I don't think there is a unifying thread through it. And but I'm very reluctant to describe it as an old man's book. We're all allowed to have an off day. And I think actually John le Carré was being a bit, taking a bit of a liberty, given that he has written a novel that when he was 89, you know, 3 years older than Graham Greene, and nobody, he wouldn't thank anybody if somebody said, oh, le Carré is written out at 89, no longer with us, of course, but the book's published imminently. So I think the fact that Green was writing the novel in his mid-80s and the Carré is writing a novel in his late 80s is fantastically good news for somebody like me, assuming I make it there, you know, because I don't agree with this idea that, you know, Martin Amis, who's a friend of mine, has gone on record saying all writers, all novelists do their best work before they're 40. Please, no. I think that that Green and le Carré and many other writers you can think of are firing on all cylinders, you know, at the end of their lives, let alone the middle of their lives. But I think maybe the answer is that it's block, you know, writer's block, which is a terrible thing. And if you can't think what to write, but you want to write, people sort of flail around a bit, and they start novels and abandon novels. And I suspect that's what Green was happening with Green, that there was the germ of a very good idea there, but for whatever reasons, he couldn't quite bring it off. I think if the novel had been written in standard third person singular past tense, it would have a totally different feel to it. It's this curious, perverse decision to make it Jim's memoir that I think gets in the way of the you know, the very good bits of story that are there. It's sort of, you're constantly being reminded of the fact that this lad is in his hotel room writing what you're reading, and it sort of confuses the issue. You don't want that. You want that sort of transparent, you know, reader-writer connection with nobody in between. So I think it's not a successful novel. And as I say, in any writer's body of work, there are, you know, good, bad, and indifferent novels, and this is one of the sort of ones that didn't quite come off. But because it's his last novel, people might draw a conclusion. But I suspect it's to do with he didn't have actually something to write about, and that's why he was rooting around in his files.
Questions? Just before I come to another question, just to add to what you just said, I'm pretty sure that if you look at the manuscript of The Captain and the Enemy, which I've done in an American archive, there's at least one draft where he's got it as I, and then he goes through and changes it all to he.
Oh, right.
And I'm now speaking from memory from several years ago. I think there might even be some steps, some of the pages where it's doubled up in that way.
Oh, right.
Yes. As if you've gone through a real crisis of, have I got this right? This but is going to structure the whole thing. Which way should I go?
Yeah, it is. But it is actually the very first question that every novelist asks him or herself when they sit down to write a novel. What is the point of view? Am I going to write a novel in the first person singular or the third person singular? Am I going to use the historic present? Or some writers have even written novel with the second person singular, but the way that decision affects the whole structure of the book and the way it's read. And if you ever want to, this is my academic self speaking, if you ever want to strip down a novel and look at its moving parts, the question you should ask yourself is what point of view is operating here? Wuthering Heights is a story told to somebody who's telling us a story, and those individuals in between us and the story affect the way the novel is read and affect its power. So it's a very interesting tip if you want to look at how a novel functions, how the moving parts connect. And so when I came to read Captain and Enemy and saw this device was one that Graham used, Graham, he says familiarly, I could immediately strip the novel down. And it's how fascinating that obviously, you know, he's such a the thing about Green that I love, he's such a professional in the best sense of the word. So you look back at, as I say, look back at the body of work, and you know, he probably should have thought, I'll just write this orthodox third person past historic, but didn't, and then was lumbered with this awful thing and gamely struggled on to the end. It's not a long novel, but apparently he wasn't that happy with it, and you know, because by his standards, it doesn't really, you know, it's a sort of 6 out of 10.
Yeah, sorry, questions. Bill, wait a second, Bill. Mm-hmm. I know you've got a loud voice.
Do you, like Green, have a daily writing regime? Or what is your writing regime?
Yes, I do, actually. I try not to develop too many fetishes because often that's an excuse for procrastination. You know, I haven't got the right pencil. I can't write today. But I do write. I'm writing a novel, in the middle of a novel at the moment, and I am, not today, obviously, but I do write every day, 7 days a week while I'm writing a novel. But my method is that I plan and research and figure out the entire novel before I start on page one. I know exactly how it's going to end. I'm not writing and inventing, though I do invent, but I have a destination and I have a detailed plan of the novel I'm writing. So my daily few hours at the desk, I'm following my schema, as it were. I know I'm in the middle of chapter 9, and I know how chapter 9 is going to end, and I know how chapter 10 is going to start. That means I don't write particularly quickly, but I do write with confidence. It's not for every writer. Some writers like to hope that the muse will descend on a daily basis and furnish them with inspiration. I think that's terribly dangerous. That's how novels get abandoned. So I like to spend probably twice as long as opposed to the writing period of my novels, thinking about it, making my mistakes, going up blind alleys and turning back again, planning the thing, filling notebooks, researching, you know, buying books, buying, traveling if I need to travel, till the whole novel has a kind of, as I say, a platonic existence in my head and in my notebooks, and then I start on page one. But I know exactly how page 403 is going to end, and in some cases I've actually written the last paragraph of my novel before I've started on page one. But that's just my method. So it's I think Green wrote a modest amount each day. I think, was it 400 words a day was his sort of target? Well, I write much more than that in a day, and I'm not entirely sure I believe him, to be honest. But it sounds good. It sounds Flaubertian, you know. But it's you do need you do need discipline, you do need rigor, and you do need stamina, because it takes so long to write a serious novel that if you haven't got those qualities or those reserves, you're going to fizzle out, you know, around about page 100 probably. Yeah, I write in longhand because I'm a pre-computer writer, and I then transfer it to the computer and edit it on the computer. But the first draft is always written in ink on spiral-backed notebooks, narrow faint. So there is a bit of a fetish.
Other questions?
I've recently read Waiting for Sunrise, and reverting to the idea of writing in the first person or the third person, you were a great exponent of that, I believe, in Waiting for Sunrise. Can you explain why you did it and what you think was the inventive step? Because it is actually quite unusual.
Well, I think in Waiting for Sunrise, I have first-person singular and third-person singular. I've done that quite a lot, actually. It allows you to have your cake and eat it, basically, that you can describe as, you know, the novelist writing about these people objectively, and he went into the building and sat down. But then you can, if you've set it up properly, you can cut to the inner thoughts of this individual you're talking about. And so you get another angle on that person. Those thoughts may be wrong-headed or not understanding the situation the person's in, but it allows you to make that character fully three-dimensional. And so it's a device I've used quite a lot for exactly that reason. In that novel, Waiting for Sunrise, he's a young, damaged actor in Vienna in 1913, and his psychiatrist says, just write down every dream you have or every thought you have in a notebook. And so we get extracts from this notebook that he's keeping that's interspersed the orthodox third-person narration. I have written whole novels in the first-person singular, but not as many as the third-person, and I think that the first-person singular is very attractive because it's confessional, and so there's an instant rapport between the reader and the character, the central character who's narrating the novel. But again, it comes down to point of view. Because you're restricting yourself to that one person's point of view, it's very hard to describe other things that he or she hasn't witnessed, which you can do with orthodox third-person narration. So it's kind of horses for courses. You know, it's the sort of novel you want to write and the sort of effect you want to achieve determines that choice of pronoun. There's there are various choices available to you as a novelist. I mean, there's omniscience, which is, you know, very popular in the great Victorian novelists, where the novelist hovers as God above his characters and tells you what they're thinking. Each one jumps from head to head and says, you know, Miss Sally thought this and Mr. So-and-so thought that, and then occasionally will interject, as Dickens did or as Trollope did, in his own person and tell you what to think or how to react. But it's kind of dated, that form. Le Carré used it a great deal, interestingly, and was very manipulative and slightly tricky. Didn't obey the rules of omniscient narration. But it sort of dates your book, I feel. So I always choose very distinct points of view and make it very clear the organization of points of view. I wrote a novel called Ordinary Thunderstorms, which has 8 voices in it. But each voice is contained to their own chapter. And so as you move from chapter to chapter, you move into the head of another character. So overall, the novel, it looks like an omniscient novel, but basically it's a story is told by 8 different people. But these are very technical decisions that you take as a serious novelist. So you can look at novels and see where people haven't a clue about technique and the consequences of their botched efforts to tell a story. But there's a technical side to novel writing, and I think it all stems from that first decision. Will I say I got up in the morning, or will I say she got up in the morning? And from that, everything else depends.
Thank you. I recently finished reading The Captain and the Enemy, and I was struck by how much of the... this is probably linked to the fact that they were Jim's memoirs, but in how much of the book that there's a sense of just waiting around for the captain, both in Camden and then in Panama, just for him to show up. So I wondered, in your adaptation, will that kind of be the same, sort of, will there be an emphasis on the absence of the captain, and to what extent could you play around with that and actually focus on what the captain's up to, kind of away from the story?
Totally. This is the great advantage of film, because it is so objective. We in the film can cut away to the captain and see what he's up to. There's a reference in the novel to a not sure if he participated in a jewel robbery. I don't know if you remember that. But we in the film, we will see what he does and how he helps the guys robbing the jeweler. So we cut away from Jim and Lisa, and we see the captain up to no good and realize how he makes his money. Similarly, in Panama, you know, we cut away from Jim because there is no, as it were, I persona in a film, because it's photography. We're all looking at the characters, and you can
you know, you could argue that the film would be Jim's film because he's perhaps on screen more than anybody else, but the very fact that it's so objective allows us this freedom that Green doesn't have, because Jim doesn't know what the captain's doing, so because Green's occupying Jim's voice, he can't tell us what the captain's doing. And it's sort of frustrating in a way. That's one of the interesting things about the adaptation. It will allow us to flesh out things that are hinted at or guessed at in the novel.
Other hands going up? Time for another one, perhaps, if anyone's got a...
Thank you very much for that. Lots of insights. Totally agree with you about the point of view. Absolutely right. And also agree with you about that the structure of The Captain and the Enemy is filigranous, to use one of the captain's favourite words. Do you love the fact that he was rumoured to have been in prison and had half a dictionary, so that up to between A and G, he's got a brilliant vocabulary, but nothing beyond?
Yes, I think that's great. And that's another good example of what you would find very difficult to get across in a film. You can do it effortlessly in a novel, but if you tried to do that in a film, how would you do it? Have two people talking to each other. Oh, I only had a dictionary that went up to F and G. That's why all the long words I know, you know, it would be terribly laborious. And somebody like me who writes novels and writes films, and I've directed a film as well, when I move from one world to the other, I'm completely aware of this vast difference between the two art forms. And the world of the novel is the world of total freedom and liberty. You can do absolutely anything you want. You move into the world of film, you're suddenly in a world of parameters and compromises and impossibilities. Not to say that film has its own strengths, but compared to the freedom you've left behind you, you're suddenly constrained, and you're suddenly, oh, I can't do that, or if I do it, it'll be clunky. And somebody once said, and it's a bit facetious, but I always quote it anyway, that writing a novel is like swimming in the sea, and writing a film is like swimming in the bath. And it's a bit crude, but it sort of shows you the problems that you have when you move from one medium to the other, and one art form to the other. And I love writing films, and it's a parallel life I have with my novel writing life, but artistically, there's no comparison because of this extraordinary freedom you have as a novelist.
Can we put our hands together to thank William for such a wonderful talk? Thank you very much.